Okay, so time to get started. All right, so on the board, I just put down some stuff that came back from that worked out in the first lecture. So the Gauss-Kodaty equations that relate the four-dimensional Riemann tensor to quantities defined on the hypersurface, and same thing for the Einstein tensor. So we'll talk about these things in the lecture this afternoon. And here I'm just reproducing the definition, covariant definition for the extrinsic curvature. And I'm putting down some stuff that I just said in words in the morning. So various way we can write this out, taking advantage of the fact that we're dealing with a symmetric tensor here. So we can write it in fully symmetrized form like this. And then we recognize that it's actually related to the Lie derivative of the full metric in the normal direction. Okay, so we were in the process of looking at some examples, so I'll look maybe at a couple more, and then we'll move on. So we looked at the sphere, we looked at the cylinder, now I'm going to look at, so we looked at the Schwarzschild t equal constant, so I'm going to look at what's called the Pain-Levy Goldstrand slice of Schwarzschild. So we're still dealing with the static spacetime, but now I'm going to take a slice, namely a space-like surface in that spacetime that's not going to be the same as the one we considered before, and that will give us a non-zero extrinsic curvature. All right, so we're still working in Schwarzschild. And now I'm going to make a very specific choice for F. So it's going to be tied, you know, the example is going to be tied to the actual Schwarzschild spacetime before I could do any static spherically symmetric metric, but now I'm really restricted to Schwarzschild. And we're going to look at a space-like surface. And I'm going to take that surface to be described by the following equation. And it's going to look very strange, and it's going to look very arbitrary and sort of, you know, sort of random, but I'm going to explain why I made this choice in a few minutes, and you're going to see why this choice is interesting. So here's the choice of surface. It's going to be t plus a function of r that I'm first going to express as an integral. And the integral is going to be the integral of square root of 2m over r divided by r, divided by f, and then integrated over r. So that's what I mean. It looks completely random, completely arbitrary, but you know, there is a reason behind this that will be revealed later. The integral can be done, and the outcome for the integral is this. It's a complicated function. Square root r minus 2 r divided by 2m, and then it's half log of r over 2m under the square root minus 1 divided by r over 2m under the square root plus 1. So that's my hypersurface. That's the description of my hypersurface. And, well, the point is that it's a scalar function of t and r. Theta and phi are sort of not playing a role here, and we'll check in a moment that this is indeed a space-like surface. Now, why would we consider this? Well, the reason I'll explain in a moment. In terms of visualizing this, that can be a little bit tricky, but one useful way of doing this is through a Kruskal diagram. So if that doesn't mean anything to you, don't pay attention. But for those who know what Kruskal diagrams are, it's a representation of the full space-time manifold that is described by the Schwarzschild metric, and it has, you know, two copies of each r equal constant surface, a usual, and you know, two copies of the event horizon, two copies of the singularity, and all of this. The normal t equal constant surfaces on a Schwarzschild diagram would be looking like this. That's what we considered before, but this space-like surface is actually something that looks like that. The drawing is very schematic, but the key point is that this is a surface that actually smoothly crosses the event horizon. And you know, for each value of phi, we have one of those hypersurfaces. So this would be phi equals 0, phi equals 1, phi equals 2. And we have a whole bunch of space-like surfaces like this that smoothly penetrates the event horizon. And you know, something that might be considered would be to use that as a new time coordinate. And that would be one way of solving the coordinate problem of t across the Schwarzschild horizon. So we'll talk about all of those things later when we finally talk about black holes in a couple of weeks. Anyway, so that, if that helps, good. If not, don't mind it. We're going to just play, play with the mathematics associated with that function. Okay, so what I want to do here is to do the usual. We're going to look at the intrinsic metric associated with that surface, and we're going to look at the extrinsic curvature. Okay, so so I claim it's a space-like hypersurface. We're going to be confirming this in a moment. And if I want to calculate the normal vector, all I have to do, apart from maybe the need to rescale this, would be to calculate the gradient of the function phi. And here I will just say, to save time, that the gradient of phi is itself a normal vector, is itself a unit vector, so we don't need to renormalize it to get a unit normal out of it. So this straight definition will just do. And when we take the gradient of the function phi, well, we're going to take, derivative with respect to t, that's going to give us a 1. We're going to take a derivative of that radial function over here. That will give us 2m over r under the square root divided by f. And then nothing depends on theta, nothing depends on phi. And we insert the minus sign to turn that gradient into a future pointing vector. Okay, so that's the normal vector. And if you calculate the norm of the normal vector using the Schwarzschild metric, you're going to find that it's minus 1, so it's a normalized vector, and the minus sign tells us that the normal vector is time-like, therefore the surface is space-like, and it's space-like everywhere. Okay, so that's the normal vector. To find the tangent vector, what we have to do is to identify the intrinsic coordinates and work out the embedding relations and all of this. So for intrinsic coordinates, well, the simplest choice would be to recycle r, recycle theta, recycle phi. So the only thing that this relationship will allow me to do here is to get rid of t as an explicit coordinate. So as intrinsic coordinates, YA, I'm going to pick r, theta, and phi. And then the embedding relations is simply the relationship between the intrinsic coordinates and the space-time coordinates. And well, because I'm recycling all of the coordinates here, that relationship will be fairly simple. So one will give me t in terms of the intrinsic coordinates, and that I get by solving the phi equation. So I'm going to get that t is going to be phi, which is equal to a constant, minus the integral. So that's the first embedding relation, and after that, it's very simple. R is equal to r, theta is equal to theta, phi is equal to phi. To get the tangent coordinates, all I have to do is to calculate all the partial derivatives. So the intrinsic the tangent vector are just all the partial derivatives. So the one pointing in the radial direction, so it's going to be the partial derivative of all the space-time coordinates with respect to r. So we start here, and we differentiate that embedding relation with respect to R, which means that we pick up, pick up that over here. So if we differentiate T with respect to R, according to this embedding relation, we're going to get minus 2m over R divided by F. So that's dt dr. And then we move on to dr dr, which is, of course, 1. And then all the other ones are 0. So that's, you know, a little bit of a tricky thing that we have to remember, that what we're differentiating here are the embedding relations. And it's not true once we, you know, account for the embedding that T is independent of R. T depends on R because of the statement that phi is equal to a constant on that surface. So that's the first vector. And then the second vector, well, that's not all the partial derivatives with respect to theta, but now there's only one. And then the phi vector is all the partial derivatives with respect to phi, and there's only one of those. So we have our time-like normal, n, and we have the space-like tangent vectors, and that's a complete basis, and now we have everything we need to calculate everything. Okay, so what do we get from all of this? Well, I'll skip some of the calculations, as I promised I would do. And if we work out the inner products between all of those vectors, we'll get the induced metric. And I'll write it as a matrix. We're going to get 1, 0, 0, 0, r squared, 0, 0, 0, r squared, sine squared theta. So what's the meaning of this? The meaning of this is that if we write down the line element for a displacement that's contained entirely on the hypersurface, we're going to get dr squared plus r squared d omega squared. And at this point, I'm looking for a reaction because this is really remarkable. So what's remarkable about this?
It's flat.
It's flat. So this is the metric of a flat space. And indeed, that hypersurface in a highly curved spacetime is a flat, you know, has a flat geometry. So that's why I picked that that hypersurface, because it gave me that property. So in a way, that would be a way of solving the problem. You know, give me a slice of Schwarzschild that gives me a flat metric on it, and you could, you know, solve that as a partial differential equation that would give you that solution for phi in the end. So here I just reverse engineered it. I started with a known solution, and then I verified that for that hypersurface, we indeed get a flat metric.
Yep. Or it's just this particular?
You can generalize this. So there's a method you can you can follow for, in fact, any spherically symmetric metric. The only thing that you would have to worry about is whether the hypersurface is global, whether, you know, it might start at zero, but it might stop at some maximum value of R, depending on the details of the metric and the construction and all of this. So there would be some conditions to be placed on the metric functions, but if you're dealing with an asymptotic flat spacetime, then yeah, there will be a solution regardless of what metric you choose. So it's always possible to find a flat slicing like this. All right. So that pretty much tells us that while the induced metric contains part of the information, but that information is not all there is. So that's why the extrinsic curvature is important. The extrinsic curvature is the thing that will tell us that even though the space-like hypersurface is flat, it bends in space-time in order to account for the, you know, overall space-time curvature. So if we stare at the Gauss-Kadatze equations, we know that the Riemann tensor of the full space-time is non-zero. What we're saying now is that the Riemann tensor of the hypersurface is zero. but we need all of this to account for all of that. So that's a situation where KAB could not be zero, because if this were zero and this were zero, we would be dealing with that space-time. Yep?
If I plug in F equal to 1, it ends up not being a nice expression. But does that mean anything if F is equal to 1?
If F is equal to 1, then this is 0, this is 1.
Oh, right. Right.
Right. So it would be a simpler function. Yeah. Yeah. Of course, if I start with if I'm in flat space, then I don't have to work so hard. That's for sure. Okay. So that's the idea. So the extrinsic curvature here, cannot be zero because the surface has to bend in a curved space-time, even though the surface intrinsically doesn't have an extrinsic curvature, has a flat metric, sorry. And if I do the calculation here, well, I won't, bother you with the details, but it's according to, that definition over here. You just apply all the vectors, take all the derivatives, and you'll get your result. So let's see, I'll write it as a matrix. So you get, for the RR component of the extrinsic curvature, you get something like this, square root of 2m over r cubed. And then for the other ones, you get square root 2mr, and then square root of 2mr sine squared theta. And then other than that, it's just a bunch of zeros. So it's diagonal, but we get this non-trivial structure for the stress for the extrinsic curvature. And if you calculate the trace, you get minus 3/2 2m over r cubed. So there is extrinsic curvature for sure, in spite of the fact that there's no intrinsic curvature to those surfaces. Right, so that's a pretty cute example that sort of shows that, well, there's a lot going on into those quantities, HAB and KAB, when we're dealing with, hypersurfaces that are not entirely trivial. And as I said before, those slicings here can be turned into a new coordinate system for the Schwarzschild metric that happens to be regular across the horizon. And they're a fairly popular choice in some corners, and they're called Panovic-Goldstrand coordinates. It's just based on the idea that, that would be a good way of, because the slices smoothly go across the horizon, they kill the coordinate singularity that happens there, the bad behavior of T that I'm sure you've heard about.
What's the difference between that, Eddington-Finkelstein, Lowen?
Yeah. So we'll talk about Eddington-Finkelstein in some detail. The distinction is that Eddington-Finkelstein are null. So they would be null surfaces instead of space-like.
So those are for light rays and these are for massive
rays, right? Right. Yeah. Right. And then it's a matter of taste whether you like those better than these. So that's a matter of choice. Okay. So any questions about this? Okay, so what I'll do next is to sort of give some ideas of how these things are used. So in what context and how the induced metric and the extrinsic curvature are used in various situations in GR. And but before I do that, I'll just go back a little bit and talk about how this was all, sort of the initial context. When Gauss started to work on his differential geometry of surfaces, well, he came up with all of these things. Of course, he didn't, write them down in tensorial forms like this. That came later. But all of those ideas are basically contained in Gauss. And that will give me a way to answer your question, Connor, about minimal surfaces. Okay, so let's think about Gauss. And I'll just mention that very quickly, but I think it's good to be aware of this because that's the ancestor of all of this beautiful differential geometry that we use every day now. So Gauss was interested in 2D surfaces in 3D space, and of course at the time there was no particular reason to consider curved 3D spaces. So he took the underlying 3D space to be flat. That would be a natural thing to do. So here's a surface embedded in flat space. And he wanted to understand all of those geometric properties that surfaces would come with. And he wanted to understand the intrinsic part of the curvature, the extrinsic part of the curvature, and the relationship between the two. So part of the story had to do with a derivation of equations that looked more or less like this, except that they were specialized to that situation he was looking at. So here I say four-dimensional, and all of those things are hypersurface related, therefore three-dimensional. But we could have done all of this starting from 3D and boil it down to 2D. But if we do it in, so I could put a 3 here and nothing would change. There's nothing here that depends on dimensionality. But if we're working in 3D flat space, then this and that are both zero. And if that is zero, then we have a relationship between the purely intrinsic curvature of the surface and the purely extrinsic aspects of that geometry. So the first thing that Gauss worked out is that relationship between the intrinsic curvature of the surface and epsilon in that case would be plus one, and the purely extrinsic aspects of the geometry. So that was one of his first results, and to him that was something that was pretty amazing, because he had a very explicit relationship, necessary relationship between intrinsic geometry and extrinsic geometry. Something that now looks completely natural and expected based on, having this knowledge that the underlying space could itself be curved. But if it's not curved, then it's a matter of necessity to have inequality between the intrinsic curvature and the extrinsic aspects of the geometry. Now, in 2D, things simplify even beyond that. So that equation is perfectly valid, but the full Riemann tensor in 2D amounts to just one independent component that we can relate to the Ricci scalar, something that that under Gauss is called the Gaussian curvature. It's the same thing as the Ricci scalar, except for a factor of two. So this whole thing here boils down to the Ricci scalar. And this whole thing over here, what we could do is to write the right-hand side in terms of the eigenvalues of the extrinsic curvature. So if I write the eigenvalues of KAB as K1 and K2, so we have, it's a two-dimensional matrix that will have two eigenvalues, then what we have here is a relationship between the Ricci scalar, or with the factor of 1/2, it's now called the Gaussian curvature, and the principal curvatures of the surface measured in terms of the bending, measured in terms of the extrinsic geometry. So that's the equation that, at least the equivalent form of the equation that Gauss arrived at, and he called this a remarkable theorem, again, because he had a very clean relationship between extrinsic curvatures, principal curvatures, and something that's purely intrinsically defined on the surface. So that's the Gauss result, and we can see that it comes out as a natural outcome of the formalism we developed this morning. Another way to write this out would be to write the eigenvalues in terms of the radii of curvature, and that's just basically saying that K1, the principal curvature, is by definition 1 over the radius of curvature associated with that eigendirection, and K2 is 1 over the principal radius of curvature associated with that direction. So another way to state this would be to relate the Ricci scalar, or the Gaussian curvature, to the principal radii of curvature. And that's something that you'll often see, you know, in various places, sometimes even in the physics context. For example, if you're investigating the physics of soap bubbles, the physics of soap bubbles is basically, you know, producing a relationship between the difference in pressure across the inside and the outside of the bubble, and that's going to be related to the surface tension on the wall of the bubble and the radii of curvature. I was very puzzled by this result for a very long time until I realized that when people talk about radii of curvature, they're really talking about the extrinsic curvature. And whereas it's very difficult to calculate those eigenvalues and calculate for an arbitrary surface the radii of curvature, it's a matter of triviality to calculate the extrinsic curvature. And when you understand this, you understand that, you know, the physics of soap bubbles is, you know, not as mysterious as I thought it was at first. Anyway, so that's one aspect that relates to, you know, the old classical literature on the differential geometry of surfaces, and I think it's something to be aware of. Another aspect of this, and it's also related to that classical work, is relating the extrinsic curvature to the variation of the area of a surface. And here I'm going by memory, so I might screw up my factors of two or something like that. But the idea is this. So suppose that I look at some two-dimensional surface, and I ask what will happen to its area if I change the surface a little bit. I make a tiny displacement of the surface, characterized by some displacement vector, I'll call it xi. So the idea is that I take a point on the surface and I displace it by some amount xi, and I do that at every point on the surface, so I have a deformation of the initial surface. So the idea is that, well, I have the area of the surface that would be defined by, the integral over the area density across the surface. And then if I want to calculate how much the area changes under displacement, then it's just a matter of figuring out, how the bounds of integration will change, how the metric determinant will change, and then, you know, doing a long calculation that will tell us how to express the change in area. And here's where I'm going by memory. If you actually work this out, you're going to find that the change in area, there might be a plus or minus sign here in front, there might be a numerical factor, but it's going to be given by the integral of the trace of the extrinsic curvature that multiplies the displacement vector that multiplies the area element in a directed sense. So here it's the area element in the normal direction, so directed along the normal vector to the surface. So, what's the meaning of this? Well, the meaning of this is that the extrinsic curvature, not too surprisingly, because it describes all of those bendings, the extrinsic curvature is what allows you to calculate the change in surface area if you know by how much you're displacing it. And that gave rise to a theory of minimal surfaces. Namely, can you find surfaces for which any infinitesimal displacement will not change the area? So a minimal surface, in a classical sense, is a surface such that after an infinitesimal displacement that's completely arbitrary, so an arbitrary vector field C on the hypersurface, produces zero change in the surface area. And now we have a theorem. We have a theorem that you have a minimal surface provided, and, you know, provided only that the extrinsic curvature vanishes, the trace. So for a minimal surface, if you want this integral to be zero regardless of the displacement inside the integral, it's got to be true that that minimal surface has to have a vanishing trace for the extrinsic curvature. And that gave rise to literature on finding, two-dimensional surfaces embedded in three-dimensional space that would satisfy this property. Some of them were identified very quickly, and some of them, came much later, and they required very fancy constructions that are sort of difficult to, difficult to visualize. But it turns out that there's a connection to soap films, because it so happens that soap films, if you put some soap into a frame and you look at the resulting shape, well, that shape has the property of being, that surface has the property of being a minimal surface. And that comes from the physics of the soap bubble that I was describing before, the interface between, air on one side, the other air on the one side, the soapy film that you have in between satisfies some fluid mechanics, and the fluid mechanics is such that it gives you zero extrinsic curvature, and therefore it gives you a minimal surface. So a very good way of finding a minimal surface is to make up a frame and digging the frame into soapy water, and whatever shape you end up with is going to be a minimal surface, as dictated by physics. Yep?
Sorry, would you mind explaining what chi is again? So every single point on the surface is moved by a factor, an infinitesimal factor in the direction of chi.
A little displacement. And you can make that displacement arbitrary. So you move every point in an arbitrary fashion so that the initial surface gets deformed. Right? So that's to answer your question. So the terminology was taken over to four-dimensional space-time. So if you have a hypersurface in four-dimensional space-time that has the property of having trace k to be equal to zero, then that's by definition a minimal surface. And then it was discovered that minimal surfaces have nice properties, and some known space-times, they tend to avoid the singularity. And then it was used as a way to as a slicing condition in numerical simulation waveforms to try to avoid hitting the singularity when you're evolving the Schwarzschild metric. So it all comes from that, from that context.
And to your point, I understand why that would be singularity.
That, I don't have that intuition. And I don't know if one can be...
By avoiding, if you evolve this surface, right?
Mm-hmm.
You won't get anything.
Right. So the idea is that you could do a minimal slice of Schwarzschild, and then it would tend to, so as it evolves in time, it will avoid, meeting the singularity, which is a useful property for numerical simulations, because you want to avoid crashing the code by encountering singularities. But why, why k equals zero would have that effect, that I don't know why, I never. Sorry, what?
Look like the minimal the surface in Schwarzschild?
Oh, I don't know. I don't remember that, and I don't remember whether you can have them and have a spherically symmetric. I don't remember. You would find that in books on numerical relativity. They tend to discuss these things there.
So is there, trying to build this situation, like I imagine, I take a three-dimensional slice of four-dimensional space-time that has this minimal, I guess, volume property where k equals zero, this delta v equals zero. Does it mean something that there's a singularity in there? What does that mean about the volume? Does the volume diverge or something?
I don't know. Maybe you can try and understand it this way, but I just don't have that in my head right now. Okay, so anyway, so that goes to show that, extrinsic curvature long predates general relativity, and there were some very nice applications of this, starting from Gauss. And as I said, there's a connection to physics. If you happen to be interested in soap bubbles or soap films, you'll find in this guise the extrinsic curvature buried in a description of these things. Okay, but now I want to focus on applications that are really directly related to GR. And there are basically two of them, one having to do with the initial value formulation of general relativity, and the other one having to do with junction conditions. So we'll talk about that in turn. So let's think of an initial value formulation or an initial value problem in GR. And before I tackle GR, let's think of something a little bit simpler. And let's say we're dealing with flat space, flat, you know, 4D spacetime, good old Minkowski spacetime. And let's look at a simple problem that we might wish to solve in 4D, four-dimensional spacetime, in 4D flat spacetime, namely the wave equation for a scalar field, good old Klein-Gordon equation. And then the question is, how do you know what conditions do we need to provide at the initial time that will guarantee that we have a unique solution in the future? That's the standard way of, you know, there are more precise way of talking about this, but that's the idea of an initial value problem. What data do you need to provide at the initial moment that guarantees that the wave equation will have a unique solution thereafter? So if we're talking about Minkowski spacetime, well, it's sort of natural to say that the initial moment is going to be a t equal constant surface. Let's take it to be t equals zero. And what we want to do is to, you know, give initial data on that space-like hypersurface that guarantees the uniqueness of the solution. And, well, I mean, people have worked this out, and the solution to that problem is that, well, in order to get a unique solution, you have to specify the value of the field on that surface, but that's not enough. You also have to provide the initial value for the field time derivative. So if the field is known everywhere at t equals zero, and if the time derivative of the field is known everywhere at t equals zero, then the statement is that the wave equation has a unique solution. If you don't provide all of this, you don't have a unique solution. If you provide more than this, well, you don't have a solution. So that's the initial data that you need. So phi at zero and derivative of phi at zero. All right, so that's pretty well known, that's pretty well understood, and that's pretty much the statement that comes from any field equations that, you know, involves second derivatives. You could complicate the equation, have, you know, nonlinear terms, you could have first derivative nonlinear terms. None of this would change the statement that in order to get a unique solution, you need to provide those two pieces of initial data. So that's the initial data for a scalar field in flat space. And then we could ask, okay, well, what, suppose that we want to generalize those statements to a curved spacetime, but thinking of the curved spacetime as being given to us. So for example, Schwarzschild, or for example, an expanding cosmology or whatever, you know, what would be the, you know, the statement we would want to make in that context? So if we go to a curved spacetime, well, now we want to be a bit more geometrical. We don't want to say that the initial surface necessarily has to be t equals zero, because what do we mean by t anyway? So what we would have to do now is to ask, well, what data on any space-like surface is needed to provide a unique solution? So it's the same problem, except that now my space-time has changed. It might now be a time-dependent space-time. So instead of having, a restricted choice of hypersurface, we will want to say that, well, the initial hypersurface that we might pick, you know, would be, you know, has to be general. It cannot be restricted in any way, so long as it's space-like. So it has to be a space-like surface. But I have to be able to, you know, to specify any space-like hypersurface to formulate my initial value problem. Otherwise, there would be some, you know, restrictions that are not germane to the problem and are not necessary to, you know, to the statement of this initial value problem. So it has to be any space-like hypersurface. And the idea is that we would want to provide the right amount of initial data on that space-like hypersurface to guarantee that the evolution in the future would be unique. So basically, we want to generalize these notions here to something that you know, applies to a space like hypersurface. And I'll just tell you what the answer is, but I think the answer is very plausible. What you need to do is to specify the value of the field everywhere on that surface. And what plays the role of the time derivative is going to be the normal derivative of the scalar field, with the understanding that the normal is a time-like vector. So what you provide here is the normal derivative of the scalar field on the hypersurface. And that's a suitable generalization to curve spacetime of what we were doing before. So basically, the initial data is the pair field evaluated on the hypersurface and the normal derivative of the field evaluated on the surface. And if you specify all of that, then the theorems say that you have a guaranteed unique solution in the future. So, well, now we're getting somewhere. So that's a scalar field in curved spacetime. What about doing a metric in curved spacetime and applying all of this to GR? Well, that's the natural next step, so let's take it. So for GR, now we're trying to solve the Einstein field equations. And the idea would be, well, let's specify an initial moment in time that would be formulated as a general space-like hypersurface. And let's provide conditions at that initial moment in time that specify, you know, the initial state of the system. And let's figure out what is needed on that initial moment in order to provide a unique solution to the Einstein field equations everywhere in the future. Now, there are lots of complications that go into it, one of which having to do with the fact that you'll never get a unique solution, because you can always take a metric and transform it to any other metric by doing a coordinate transformation. So you have to factor in all of the diffeomorphism aspects of this. I'm not going to even go into that. But the issue here is, what do we need to specify at the initial moment? So the initial moment, again, has to be any space-like hypersurface we care to define. So let's draw it again as a sort of general curve like this, space-like everywhere. And we know that the Einstein field equations are second order, so it's sort of natural to expect that the initial data should be something like the metric on the hypersurface and the normal derivative of the metric on the hypersurface. And if we specify both, then we should get a unique solution. And of course, that doesn't make much sense. And we're going to have to work a little bit harder than this, because, well, for two reasons. First of all, well, this operation obviously gives us zero, so that's not the notion of normal derivative we would want to define. Maybe, maybe what we would need here is a Lie derivative of the metric or something like that. And now we're getting a little bit closer to the truth. But still, that doesn't make any sense, because we're providing too much information. And here's the idea. Let's think about, specifying the metric on the hypersurface. So here's the hypersurface. And if I try to specify all of the metric on the hypersurface, I would be talking about information that's, intrinsic to the metric, but I would also be talking about information that has to do with stuff that goes away from the hypersurface. Here's what I mean. Part of that metric here describes the intrinsic metric that I can define purely on the hypersurface, and that characterizes displacements that are entirely confined to the hypersurface. And that part of the metric is something that has geometrical meaning on the hypersurface. That is meaningful. Everything else, the remaining components of the metric, well, you know, think back on the Gaussian coordinate. They really represent how, you know, we make our choices of coordinates as they're supposed to, you know, to be carried away from the hypersurface. So for Gaussian coordinates, we were talking about geodesics, you know, going away from the hypersurface at right angles, orthogonally. We were saying that the coordinates should be carried by those geodesics as we go away from the hypersurface. So we were making all sorts of choices like this. And the remaining components of the metric that are not those just reflect all of those choices that we make. But the point is that we have, you know, complete freedom over those choices. So all of those extra things here that correspond to coordinate choices are not defining meaningful geometrical information on the hypersurface. And that's, you know, leading us to the conclusion that attempting to specify all of the metric on the hypersurface at the initial moment would be specifying way too much, because all that we can provide as information, if we want to do it in a meaningful way, is geometrical information that we can only get in terms of the relevant components of the metric, namely the induced metric. So we have to give up on that, and we have to sort of, you know, accept the fact that if we want to provide meaningful information on that surface, it's got to be only in terms of the induced metric. Everything else has to do with stuff that reflects choices on how we choose to go away from that hypersurface and is not meaningful to describe just the initial moment. It would not be just initial data. It would be making, you know, choices about the future. All right, so that's the first conclusion. So the initial value problem has to involve only the induced metric. And then it has to involve something that will play that role of the normal derivative of the metric. And I think by now, well, you can guess what that is. The only meaningful geometrical object that, you know, that sort of gives us that kind of information is the extrinsic curvature. So bottom line is that if we want to formulate the initial value problem in GR in a way that makes sense from a geometrical point of view, and I think we do want to do that, we have to agree that the initial value problem has to be such that the valid initial data that we would choose on a hypersurface must be restricted to a choice of metric, induced metric, and a choice of extrinsic curvature. And if the whole theory makes sense mathematically, that should be possible, that should be admissible. And the theory should then tell us how these things must evolve in time as we're trying to construct a solution, not just on the hypersurface, but in the future. And what I'm saying is that, well, fortunately, things do work out. People who invested a lot of effort in trying to understand the structure, mathematical structure of the Einstein-Fields equation in terms of an initial value formulation came up with this as a very firm mathematical theorem that says that the initial value formulation is specify this, specify that, and then the field equations, the Einstein-Fields equations, will give us evolution equations for these basic quantities. So we can think of GR as being basically a theory involving two spatial tensors, induced metric, extrinsic curvature, and the field equations provide us with evolution equations for these things. So you specify them at one instant of time, so to speak, and then the field equations will tell us how to update those as we move up in time. And, you know, if you're an adept of numerical relativity, it's basically that, except that it has to be done in a much cleverer way than this. But that's basically the essence of the idea, that we split, you know, the information this way through an induced metric extrinsic curvature, and then the field equations tell us how to evolve these things, you know, from one moment of time to the next. You had a question?
So I guess I don't quite agree that this is completely general way to think about it, because there's no reason why I couldn't say evolve the normal vector as well.
Oh, so I don't claim that it's unique. there are lots of ways you can formulate the field equations in terms of all sorts of different choices of variables. What I'm saying is that this is one way of doing it, and that, you know, that that is basically the, you know, the sort of the more geometrical way of, you know, of describing the initial value formulation.
But if I do want to evolve the normal vector, then I can imagine specifying the whole metric and its derivatives on the initial slice.
Yeah, so you can always play games of introducing additional variables and introducing relationships between those new variables and the old ones, and trading your, what is part of the, so basically redefining the dynamical system so that you have something that is better behaved in terms of, you know, computer simulations and things like that. And people have done all sorts of things along those lines. But, you know, the starting point is always something like this, where you start with meaningful geometrical things defined purely on the hypersurface, and then you determine how those need to evolve as you go away from that hypersurface. Yep, so that's only the starting point. And if you read any book on general relativity, they'll tell you all of the things that need to be done in order to make this actually work in real simulations. Now, something interesting, that needs to be said about all of this is that we don't have the latitude to choose any metric and choose any extrinsic curvature as initial data. That would not work. And the reason has to do with those Gauss-Kodaczy equations. That initial surface that we're talking about will have some matter in it, and the matter will be described by a stress tensor. And the stress tensor will be related to the Einstein tensor by the field equations. And that equation right here tells us that the scalar curvature associated with the induced metric and the extrinsic curvature have to be in the right combination to reflect the presence of matter on the slice. And that's true for this equation, that's true for that equation right here. So those equations, and the word came up this morning, those equations represent constraints that we have to impose on the initial data in order to have valid initial data that would not be incompatible with the Einstein field equations. So we have constraints equations, or simply constraints. And the constraints come from the Gauss-Kodaczy equation. So let me just throw in the factor of 1/2 over to the left-hand side. Epsilon in this context is -1, so we get R minus KAB plus K squared. That's got to be equal by the Gauss-Kodaczy equation, so that's purely geometrical, to twice the normal component to the Einstein tensor. But now I'm going to use the field equations and say that this must be equal to the normal component of the stress tensor, and that's basically a measure of energy density on the initial surface. So in the presence of matter, or even in vacuum, even if we had a zero right-hand side here, we would not be able to choose the metric, arbitrarily and the extrinsic curvature arbitrarily. We would have to make sure that those are chosen in such a way that this equation is satisfied. And that's true for that equation, and it's true for the other one. So the other one imposes a constraint on the derivative of the extrinsic curvature. That would have to be equal to 4 pi times the normal tangential component to the stress tensor, and that would be a measure of the matter current on that hypersurface. So in the presence of matter, or even in vacuum, even if we had a zero right-hand side here, we would have to choose the extrinsic curvature in such a way that that this constraint equation is satisfied. And that just means that, well, there's a complexity already in finding suitable initial data on initial surface. You have to impose initial data that satisfies the constraints. So that's the first thing that needs to happen. You need to find solutions for H and K that are compatible with the constraints. And only once you have that, you know, you can try to see how things evolve in time. If you don't solve the constraints initially, you introduce already a violation of the Einstein field equations at the initial moment. And of course, any evolutions from there will be completely, you know, violating the field equations as well. You can show that if you have initial data that do satisfy the constraints, then the constraints will remain satisfied from any, you know, on any space-like surface thereafter. So that tells you that, you know, there's a lot going on here when it's time to solve the Einstein field equations and this sort of initial value idea. Just the setup of the initial value is far more complicated than was the case, for example, for the Skiller field, where you could arbitrarily select a field configuration and its time derivative. You didn't have any constraints to be satisfied in that context. You could choose those, arbitrarily. Here, you can't. You have to be very careful about your choices here. They have to satisfy the constraints. And a lot of work has gone over the years in trying to find strategies to do that. And of course, in numerical relativity, that's the starting point. You know, you want to set up a simulation of binary black holes. The initial data has to satisfy the constraints. And people had to come up with, you know, ways to do that. That was the starting point to the whole thing. And once you have, you know, a proper solution for the initial data, then you can evolve that numerically, you know, in those simulations. And, you know, if your code is well behaved and has all the right properties, the constraints will stay valid at all times. In reality, they always, you know, start deviating a little bit from zero, but, you know, if the deviation is not too far, is not too large, then you're fine and, you know, you can live with it. Yep, Connor.
Do the constraints still play a role in linear asperity, or do they just become 10 discrete field equations?
They would certainly play a role, but I think, of course, everything would simplify. And if you formulate your linearized theory in the usual way by, you know, perturbing around flat space and using the gauge freedom to write this as a wave equation, I think a lot of that simplifies to a large extent. I think in the end, you don't have to worry too much about them. I think it's all built in. And it's built into the fact that, I don't know. I'm aware that this issue is rarely discussed in linearized theory. And that must be that either you don't have to worry about it or that no one has worried about it and discoveries are waiting to be made. So I think the first option is probably most likely. But yeah, in principle, you know, you can't get away from the constraints because otherwise you're going away from the Einstein field equations. Okay, so questions about that?
Can I think heuristically that, so these are only more components of T that are more than energy density, right?
Well, that's an energy density. That represents basically a current.
So T is for L.
So yeah, so it would be T spatial.
Yeah. So can I think of it as like some matter, right? So I'm trying to think why the just pure spatial parts of T doesn't really impose any constraints. Is that because of the gauge freedom, the diffeomorphism, perhaps?
No, I think the reason is deeper than this. I think it really has to do with Gauss-Gadazzi. So the evolution equations will come from all the remaining components,
yeah.
Right? So the remaining components can be formulated in terms of derivatives acting on the extrinsic curvature, and these will correspond to the spatial components of the stress tensor. So they will be algebraically related to that. But the underlying reason for this sort of structure really comes from that, you know, differential geometry that's, of course, inescapable. Yeah, so there's some nice, you know, connection between geometrical considerations and considerations that are limited to a specific theory of gravity when you equate the Einstein tensor to a stress tensor. All right, questions about this? Okay, so basically that's all I wanted to say about the initial value problem. And the purpose here was to make you aware of important applications of the extrinsic curvature. And if you've heard any talk on numerical relativity in the last 30 years, you've heard about constraints, you've heard about these things, and you'll keep hearing about that. All of this has a role to play in the quantum theory. So in the quantum theory, you want to define your canonical variables. And one way of doing this would be to basically convert this into sort of Hamiltonian type variables. There's a Hamiltonian version of all of this that is quite nice, quite elegant. And that's the kind of thing that can be turned into a quantum theory. But that's just one way of trying to formulate a quantum theory. So all of those things are very important. So that's it for the initial value problem. And the other main application of extrinsic curvature in induced metric has to do with junction conditions. So that's what I wanted to talk about next. And I think that'll be it for today. So before I talk about GR, let's maybe fall back on something a little bit more familiar and something that you've studied, I hope, during your undergrad. So let's talk about electromagnetism, and I'll forget about magnetism, so let's just focus on electrostatics, just as a warm-up example. So here's the sort of thing I would want to talk about. Suppose that I have a boundary here. So that would be, in this case, a two-dimensional surface in 3D space. And suppose that I have one solution to Maxwell's equations that gives me an electric field on the minus side of the surface. And suppose that I have another solution to Maxwell's equation that gives me a solution for the electric field on the right, on the opposite side. So let's imagine that we're playing this game where we have one solution here, another solution here, and then we want to investigate whether we can join those solutions together at the common boundary. Well, Maxwell has some rules about this. You cannot just do it. You can do it, if the joining of the solution satisfies two conditions. So the one is that the normal component to the electric field has to be continuous, and the other one is that the tangential component to the electric field must be continuous. So my bracket here means evaluate it on one side and then take the difference between the evaluation on the other side. So psi, so this over here is, let's take the quantity inside the bracket, evaluate it on the plus side, then let's take the difference between the same thing evaluated on the minus sign. And basically what I'm saying is that you can have a smooth solution according to Maxwell's equations, a valid solution according to Maxwell's equations, if both normal and tangential components to the electric field are continuous. So you would have a nice smooth transition across the hypersurface. Now, when you play this game, normally that doesn't happen, and that means that the joining of the solutions doesn't quite work. And it turns out that there's some latitude to relax that one, although you can never do away with this one. The tangential components of the electric field always has to be continuous, but there's a way of arranging for a discontinuity in the normal component, and it's if the surface is actually, where there might be a surface, distribution of charge. So if instead of just being a boundary, mathematical boundary in your space, you're saying that there might be a surface charge density on that surface, then that'll, buys you the right to have a discontinuous normal derivative. and the discontinuity in the normal derivative will be related to that surface charge. So it's okay to have, you know, an electric field that would jump discontinuously like this, with a discontinuous normal component, so long as the tangential component is continuous. So that's always required. And this, you know, if you have a discontinuity in a normal component, that means that you have a surface charge. And I'm sure you've played with surface distributions at some point during your undergrad years. So that's what I'm talking about. Maxwell's equations actually, you know, give you those conditions. So they don't come out of the blue. They are consequences of Maxwell's equations. And the way to derive them is the usual thing where you draw your surface, you have a little pillbox, and you integrate and use Gauss's theorem and all of those things. That's how all of this comes out. Okay, so you can formulate it like this in terms of the electric field, or you can formulate the junction conditions in terms of the potential. And that will take us one step closer to doing the right thing for GR. So if we have a potential V and we define the electric field as the gradient of that, then that will be the normal derivative of the potential. And that will tell us that the potential itself has to be continuous across the surface. So we can rephrase the junction conditions as a statement that the potential has to be continuous, so zero discontinuity, but we're allowing for a normal derivative discontinuity if we have a surface charge. Right, okay, so all of that I hope is somewhat known. And then the idea is, well, what if we want to do something similar in GR? And here's you know, the kind of context we would be thinking about, and I think I said a few things about that already. So suppose that we have, you know, we want to come up with a description of gravitational collapse. That would be a very good example of this. So if we're describing gravitational collapse, we're going to need basically two metrics, one that will describe the inside of the collapsing star and the metric that will describe the outside. And we know that if the collapse is spherically symmetric, that's going to be a Schwarzschild metric. So if we have a collapsing star, let me draw it like this. We're going to have the inside of the star, and it's going to have its own metric. And we're going to have the outside, and it's going to have its own metric. And then we would want to join those metrics at the common boundary, the surface of the collapsing star, and make sure that the union of those two independent solutions is actually appropriate to form a global solution to the Einstein field equations. So we would want to join this metric to that metric at the surface and make sure that the appropriate continuity conditions are satisfied. And it's only then that we go from a situation where we might have one solution to the field equations inside and another solution to the field equations outside, but now combined together in a valid solution everywhere. Because it's not a given that, like for the electric fields, you can start with two separate solutions and join them together in a way that keeps satisfying Maxwell's equations. We run up into very similar issues if we try to do this in gravity. And now the question is, you know, what do you need to do? How can you formulate those junction conditions in terms of geometrically meaningful terms? And I don't think you'll be surprised to hear that, well, the way to do that is to invoke the induced metric and the extrinsic curvature on that common boundary. So the junction surface here is a time-like hypersurface in this case. So that's what we'll be thinking about. And what we have to ensure is that, you know, the geometrical quantities on that hypersurface are such that the union of the solutions is a valid, you know, is a valid construction for all of Einstein field equations. Right, so let me try to say this a little bit. So the so the idea is here. So it's like this. So we have some, I'll draw it as a time-like surface. We have some surface sigma like this. And on the one side, we have, you know, a minus sign, we have a plus sign. And on that side over here, we have some metric that we construct in some coordinate system that describes the physics on the minus side of the hypersurface. And on that side, we have some other metric that corresponds to what happens on the other side. And, you know, in principle, we could use different coordinate systems on each side of the hypersurface because it might be convenient to work in some coordinate system over here and in some other coordinate system over here to construct those individual solutions. And in the case of gravitational collapse, I have an example fully worked out in the book that basically is just a, you know, an explication of the Oppenheimer Snyder collapse. The coordinates we choose here are very different from the coordinates we choose there because it's much simpler to do it this way. So we have two metrics on each side of the hypersurface, each formulated in its own coordinate system, and now we have to find a way to make sure that the union of the two produces a valid solution to the field equations everywhere. So basically, we need to provide the analog of this, some continuity equations that allow us to claim that the union of the two solutions is itself a valid solution. And as I said, you won't be too surprised to find out that, well, the way of formulating this in a nice, meaningful, geometrical way is to think of relating the induced metric calculated from both sides and the extrinsic curvatures calculated from both sides. So so we have two, possibly two induced metrics and two extrinsic curvatures, one that we would get when we evaluate all of that from the outside, the other one that we get from the inside. So potentially we have two induced metric on the hypersurfaces and two extrinsic curvatures on the hypersurface. And the idea is that, well, presumably we need to have some agreement between these things. I think it's pretty clear that the induced metric has to agree no matter what. Because if it turned out that your positive face has a different geometry from the negative face, that would mean that the hypersurface itself is not terribly well defined. It would have two different geometries depending on whether you look at it from the outside or the inside. And that's just not possible. It's not meaningful. It wouldn't mean anything. So in order to have, you know, a common boundary that has a well-defined geometry, intrinsic geometry, it's got to be that the two induced metrics agree from both sides. And that's the statement of continuity for the induced metric. We could insist that the extrinsic curvatures agree, but that would be asking too much. It would be like asking that the normal component of the electric field always vanishes. If we were to insist on that, we would remove any possibility that this transition surface or this boundary surface here could itself carry some matter. And here we're going to allow for something a bit more general. So the second junction condition will be a condition that states that the jump or the discontinuity in the extrinsic curvature, and then there's some technicalities here that I won't, you know, describe. I have to take out that trace term as well. This is something that would be analogous to this normal component to the electric field, and if we allow for a discontinuity, then we can do that. We can account for the discontinuity in the presence of matter. Here it was charge, now here it's going to be mass. So what we're going to have on the right-hand side is going to be 8 pi. I'll write it as SAB. It's going to be a stress tensor that's going to be associated with a thin layer of material that we might find, you know, at the surface of the collapsing star, or, you know, at the interface in more general terms. So just to make this a bit more precise, my surface density here was just the integral of the volume charge density across the surface. And this SAB here is the integral of the stress tensor projected into the tangential components integrated over the hypersurface. So it's an integral across. So this would be the surface stress tensor. And that would basically signal the presence of some matter at the transition surface. And if we do have that matter, then we have the possibility for the extrinsic curvature to be different on each side of the hypersurface. If we declare that there is no matter there, you know, that this is just a purely mathematical boundary that doesn't really correspond to the presence of anything, then SAB would be zero, and then we would be reproducing the initial statement that the jump in the extrinsic curvature would be zero, that the extrinsic curvature along with the metric, induced metric, would have to be continuous, would have to be continuous across both sides. So that's another very important application of induced metric and extrinsic curvature, because it tells us how to combine different metrics in different contexts, in different situations, including the one that's very relevant to describe the collapse of a star. And in that situation here, we would have, you know, a boundary surface that would describe the time, you know, decaying, the time shrinking surface of the star, where we go from a situation of zero density to a situation of non-zero density, but the star itself doesn't have a thin layer of material. And if you work out the details of this Oppenheimer-Snyder collapse situation, that would be a situation where both the induced metric and the extrinsic curvature are continuous. But, you know, those models can be generalized. You can formulate different models of gravitational collapse. And my favorite one is where you would declare that the spacetime inside is empty and flat. And now the collapsing object would itself be just a thin layer of material that collapses in. So that would be a situation where you would have a Schwarzschild exterior. You would have a flat interior, but you would have a layer of material between the two. And it would be that layer of material that would collapse to form a black hole. And that would be a rather simple solution to the Einstein field equations, flat inside, Schwarzschild outside. The only thing that needs to be figured out is, well, what are the properties of this surface layer that is there? And, you know, how does it collapse? How fast does it collapse? You know, work out the equations of motion for that surface layer. And all of that would be figured out by solving the junction conditions. So all of the physics would be contained in those equations. You could just formulate this, make up a model for the matter that is supposed to be living in that thin layer. And then that would give us, you know, all the information we would need to specify, you know, completely how the collapse proceeds, how fast it does. And that would be a very simple example of a dynamical, you know, solution to the Einstein field equations that produces a black hole. Oppenheimer-Snyder is, you know, not complicated, but it's a lot more complicated than this very simple one. And, you know, sometimes it's good to introduce the simplest possible model that achieves something you want to achieve, like, you know, the formation of a black hole. That would be the way to do it. And if you're curious about this, I work through all the details of that in my notes, in my book. All right, so just a couple more words. Those junction conditions are known after Israel, who formulated them in the first place. He happened to be my PhD advisor, so I sort of feel very proud of this, even though I have nothing to do with that. He did this before I was born, so I can't even claim, you know, however remotely credit. But it's something I feel quite close to, something that I find very elegant and something that I think really again, makes the point that those geometrical quantities that we define on a surface, you know, they have meaning that go back all the way to Gauss, but they have meaning that keeps on unfolding in modern GR, either through the initial value problem or through junction conditions. And, you know, you'll keep encountering that because those are, you know, very important foundational things that play a role basically all over the place. Okay, so I think that's all I had to say about all of this. So again, the purpose today was basically to give you an introduction to extrinsic curvature and emphasizes the deep meaning behind it and emphasize the fact that it is really all over the place in the GR literature and beyond GR, of course, because these notions are really just coming out of differential geometry. It has nothing to do specifically with a chosen theory of gravity. And you know, I wanted to, you know, do that, even though, you know, it's not something that we're going to recycle in later portions of the course, but it's too important to omit. Anyway, so that's, I think that's it for today. Any questions before we stop? Yep.
It almost feels like we're getting too much out of the research conditions because, you know, I guess I make some assumptions of the space-time on either side of the boundary, but in order to figure out the physics of the boundary, I just have to satisfy some first-order equations. Whereas, I said those equations are second order, so it's like, it's almost like I feel like it's too easy.
The blank check here comes from the fact that you're imposing a lot already in the choices you make for the inside metric, the outside metric. And in spherical symmetry, you have a lot of latitude to do this. If you were not in spherical symmetry, you know, you would not have all of that latitude. So you would have to determine the inside metric along with the outside metric, along with the conditions at the boundary. So it would become as hard as solving the full set of Einstein field equations. Here you buy yourself a lot of ease because, you know, you've made all of those very specific choices.
Right. I guess as long as I have two metrics that I know already satisfy the Einstein field equations, and I sandwich them on a boundary, then all I have to do is satisfy some first order equations to connect them.
Yeah, and this would work sometimes, but it wouldn't work all the time because even though you can always go through this exercise of matching across a boundary, you would still probably want to have that matter stress tensor to have a good interpretation, be compatible with the energy conditions, to have some kind of underlying fluid model behind it, or something like that. So, you know, there was an old tradition of solving the Einstein field equations by writing down any metric you wish and just reading off the stress tensor from the Einstein tensor. Well, that's going to be a valid solution to the Einstein field equations by definition, but the stress tensor you get out of it is completely meaningless. So you know, there's really no sense in playing this game unless you happen to be so lucky that the stress tensor you get out has a nice interpretation in terms of, say, a perfect fluid or, you know, an electromagnetic field or something like that. So sometimes it happens, but it's always a miracle when it does. So similar story here. Yeah. So yeah, there's no free lunch, right? So sometimes you're lucky, but typically it's because you've made symmetric choices that, you know, bring you that luck. All right, other questions? Okay, so that is it for today. So next week we'll talk about null surfaces, and after that we'll be ready to do black holes.